This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. The podcasts recently have been largely about my adventures walking up the West Highland Way, which was Scotland's first marked long-distance route. It celebrated its 40th anniversary at the beginning of October there. 40 years ago, it was catapulted into the public consciousness by one man, and that man was Jimmy McGregor. He had a radio programme and then he had a television series. Both of them were extremely popular. Now, as part of my recordings, I went back to talk to Jimmy. I used to work for him. He's 90 years old now, absolutely sharp as a tack, and I really enjoyed it. So here is the interview in its entirety with Jimmy McGregor.
For radio, we followed up with the Southern Upland Way, which is a lot longer, as you know, the Speyside Way and the Cairngorms, McGregor across Scotland, blah, blah, blah. But it just went on and on and on. I did the Ulster Walkway. And then we did this huge one in Canada, which was from downtown Toronto all the way to Thunder Bay in Alaska. So we did that one then. It was Yosemite and then the Arctic. So that one wee idea that I had, I'm going to walk the West Highland Way, just took my whole... I hate talking about my career, it sounds so pompous. Took my work in another direction and opened a whole great sphere of activity for me, and also stuff that I really loved doing.
Take me right back to when you were a kid. You know, what was your background? What did your parents
do? Funnily enough, I've got a big book there that I did, a big coffee table job called Jimmy McGregor Scotland, and I talk about my life in the tenements, because I started off in the top floor of a tenement with seven of us living in two rooms. And I know it sounds daft, but I don't remember being the slightest bit uncomfortable or unhappy. I think we had a better childhood than a lot of the kids now have, because everybody seems to be so screwed up and spending time in all these toys, you know, and... Mm. We were outdoors all the time. And there's a photograph in that book of a tenement black back court with some kids playing in the puddle and somebody up on the dikes. That's exactly my childhood. So, but I remember it with great affection. And there were five of us, three brothers and a sister. And we all got on very well. And it was a happy time. And then we moved from the tenement. I can't remember what age I would be. I'm still very young when we moved from the tenement to a council house. And people at that time, people lived up in Balgrey Hill in the big villas, were sneered at the council house. To us, it was Shangri-La. My mother was ecstatic about getting a council house. She had hot water on tap, which never happened in the tenement. Everything had to be boiled in a pan or a kettle. People don't realise just how basic it was. And, you know, she had a back and a front garden and she could plant her sweet William and all this stuff. And it was a big, big step forward for working people, you know.
Yeah. Was there always music in your house? Where did the music side of things come from?
Well, I have been asked that question before, Mark. And my tendency used to be say, oh, not at all. But that's quite wrong. It was uninformed music, if you like, you know. Mm-hmm. It was uneducated music. But we all sung. Everybody sung. And I had a lot of cousins and aunties who were hoofers in the halls, you know, chorus girls. And they could all sing. And everybody, including me as a boy, could sing harmony. And occasionally I used to say, look, is anybody holding the melody in this? You know, so it was a musical house, but as I say, uninformed music, if you like. And somebody, there was always somebody who could play the piano quite well by ear, you know, and it was a musical okay. And it was only much later that I realised that some of the songs that we'd been singing were actually folk songs. They were just songs as we were concerned, you know.
So when did you pick up a musical instrument?
Well, unlike most people, I was quite mature when I first took up the guitar. I bought my first guitar. It was either in my first or my second year at art school, and that would be 1951 or two. And I remember I bought it in a shop called Gollum's along in the Salt Market, and it was an old Abbott Victor guitar, and that's the one that went to London with me in 1956. I went to London 1956 with 60 quid in my pocket, which I thought was a small fortune.
It was a fortune back then.
And the guitar, and that was it. No job to go to or anything. But people say that was a... Because I was teaching during the day, and I was doing two nights a week back at the art school on lecturer's kind of level. So as a young single guy, I was doing fine. And people said, I'm very brave to do it. I wasn't the least bit brave. It was total self-indulgence. It was exactly what I wanted to do. Because I used to hitchhike to London at the weekends. And I realised there were a few places where you could actually hear people singing folk songs, which didn't really happen in Glasgow until quite a wee bit later. And that's why I went. And the night after I arrived, I was singing in a coffee bar called The Witch's Cauldron in England's Lane in Hampstead. And they paid me 10 bob because there was already a resident kind of singer. He wasn't exactly a folk singer, but there was him. And I said, I volunteered. I was kind of a lot more brass-necked in those days, you know. I think as you get older, you get more timid in a way, but... Uh-huh. When you're young, you just say, can you drive a submarine? Oh, I'll have a go, you know. That kind
Can't
of thing.
Everybody. Yeah.
So that was the first. And I happened to arrive auspiciously at the first upsurge of traditional jazz, skiffle particularly, and the few folk clubs were beginning, you know. So if you could play at all, you could earn a living. You could scratch along. I always used to say that if you could play three chords, you were employable. If you could play five, you were a virtuoso. And if you could play any more than that, it was just a bloody show-off, you know. So, but actually, the skiffle thing was incredible because I can remember almost to the week when every other shop in Shaftesbury Avenue became a guitar shop. It was a gigantic boom, and it happened so fast that thousands and thousands of young kids realised they could get a guitar, and within a week they could play three chords, ding, 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 you know, takes a worried man to sing a worried song. That was everybody sung that because it was dead easy, three chords. And it went from there, and the skiffle thing earned a lot of people a living for a while, you know, and... Most of them just fell by the wayside because they weren't really musical at all. And a few people moved from that into maybe proper folk song. Some of them became pop singers and a few real successes, you know. Adam Faith, for instance, you know. By that time, we had our own skiffle club. Well, I was a member of the group that had the skiffle club in 49 Greek Street. It was called the Skiffle Cellar. And it was a big venue at one time. Everybody and anybody gravitated towards it. And Adam Faith and his group used to come down once in a while, and they were paid £1 each. And they were happy to have it. They were able to, you know, play, get up and show off and get paid £1, you know. Yeah. But then, you know, for a few shillings, you could buy a meal in Jimmy the Greeks in Soho. You know, and people don't realise how cheap it was to live in that
time.
You
could get into a lot of trouble with a few shillings and so.
Yeah.
When did you and Robin become a duo?
Well, I knew Robin. Well, I didn't know him I'd seen him in Glasgow because he used to turn up at the art school dances and he would get up and sing a song, you know, and he never really registered on me particularly, you know. I always say he had a kind of idiosyncratic attitude to the blues, 12-bar blues, because he used to sing like 13 and a quarter bar blues and 9 and a half bar blues, but he was a good singer. And then much later, he came down to London about a year after I did, and he was singing in round the coffee bars. And I actually saw him in the same place that I started, the Witch's Cauldron. And by the standards of the time, he was fairly eccentric in dress. He had a pair of calfskin trousers on, and he had a fringe here and a fringe on. And of course, he had the Byronic limp and all that kind of stuff. But what struck me was this guy could really sing, you know, had a really lovely melodious voice. And I was a regular at the Skiffle, so I played there 6-7 nights a week sometimes. And Robin would turn up occasionally, and because we're both Scotties again, we had a kind of common repertoire. And we'd both been mentored by Hamish Henderson and, you know, a couple of other, Norrie Buchan, who became an MP, and Maurice Blythe, and these were the three influences, and they taught us a lot. So we had this common repertoire, so we've got, and at that time I always thought I could harmonise anything, you know. So Robin would go up and sing, and I would play the guitar. I was a better guitar player than him, marginally, and I would sing harmony. And then somehow I had been to Moscow with the Skiffle Group, 1957, the Moscow Youth Festival, gigantic event. But 2 years later, it was the Vienna Youth Festival, both very left-wing run, you know, and we had kind of connections in that direction. So we were sent to the Vienna Youth Festival independently. But again, because we were both Scottish, we were kind of chucked on stage together. And it went well, and what really pushed it a bit forward quite rapidly was that Paul Robeson was on that bill, one of my boyhood heroes, and he actually came round to the dressing room afterwards and said, "I've just been listening to her, really enjoyed what you boys did, you know." And his view was singing the songs of our own country and, you know, promoting the culture, we were just singing songs we liked, you know. But on the way back, I actually said to Robin, listen, if a guy like Paul Robeson has given you a pat on the back, maybe we should try and do something about this. And Robin immediately agreed. So we got together our repertoire, and we had a guy at the same time, a man called Malcolm Nixon, who started being an agent for the folkies. And he said, if you can put together a repertoire that sustain you on stage for 30 minutes, you know, I'll start giving you bookings around the clubs. And that's really how it all started. And then there was a lot of radio work came along, regular radio work. And, of course, the huge leap forward was the Tonight Programme.
Yes.
Which a lot of people won't even know what it was. But the Tonight Programme was the television magazine programme of the time. And people forget there was only two. There was only ITV and BBC. And it was all black and white. And it was all live. That was the other thing.
It's worthwhile explaining this because the Tonight Programme was live.
It was live.
I mean, very, very live. So that meant the entire show could fall down round about your ears in smoking ruin. So to have two musicians there who, if necessary, could fill for 30 minutes.
Well, that was we were dog's bodies. That was our function, to fill in the gaps. You know, if something went wrong, we were expected to jump in and sing a song, which we did. And that wasn't easy, because if you're one guy and you're told, you know, that you've got a floor manager signalling you to cut the thing short because they've sorted whatever problem it was. If you're one person, you can just finish the song conveniently. If there's two of you, you have to be psychic. You know, you don't want him finishing a verse before you do, you know. But actually, funny enough, that came. We very quickly kind of just sensed if we were signalled to shorten a song, we kind of arrived at a logical way of stopping, you know, of ending it. And then sometimes, of course, your song might be quite short and you were getting to extend it, you know. So it was all improvisation and terrific learning. Oh. I hate that phrase, learning curve, but it was a huge, terrific pressure to learn, because we were every day, every night, we were having to sing maybe one, sometimes two songs in a night. So you had to be keep... Once you ran out of our common repertoire, you had to be learning, learning, learning. And as quick as you learned them, you forgot them, because you make room for the next one that you've got to do. And yet they had writers, and quite often they'd phone you up at lunchtime and say, somebody like Ned Sheeran's just written some clever wee topical thing about something that happened in him, and you've got to be able to do that by tea time. And Robin and I never used idiot boards. It was idiot boards in those days. No, what's the other thing you
call it? Autocue.
The autocue, yeah. But they didn't have that. They had a cardboard thing with the words printed on it, and it was clipped underneath the camera. And we never ever used that. We made a point of learning them. And if you made a mistake, you very quickly learn just to laugh it off. If you look worried by a mistake, the audience feels for you. If you laugh it off, the audience enjoys it, actually. And we noticed after a while, I mean, this sounds so corny, we noticed after a while if we made a wee mistake and we kind of laughed it off, each other, acknowledged each other and had a giggle about it, the mail would increase by maybe 100 letters that week. So we loved it when Robin and Jimmy did, you know.
It's almost impossible to overestimate the impact that had at the time. Because, as you say, there was only two channels. You are on primetime television, sometimes five nights a week. I mean, that's a huge leap in profile.
Yeah. Well, I think it was getting between 9 and 10 million people a night. Yeah. So overnight, you became a household name. Yeah. We had to stop travelling by tube. I mean, that sounds corny as well, but... We just couldn't, because you didn't get a minute's peace. Everybody wanted to talk to you and knew your face.
Taking you back to your childhood, when did you really become interested in the outdoors?
Oh, I can't remember a time when I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was a schoolboy, when other people were playing football, I was away the weekend birds nesting, which we did in those days, and sleeping out up in Loch Lomond side. And a place called Malaricky Bay was one of the favourites. We used to sleep out, just lie out in the stones at night, you know, yeah, with a wee fire beside you. And yeah. All adventure. It was a big adventure for a schoolboy, you know.
Yeah. And in those days, it was kind of... I mean, I've got... I mean, this is pre-days, that you, obviously... But I've got a wee handbook, and it's Tramping Holidays in Scotland. And it says odd stuff, like, you know, I mean, one of the walks was go out from Glasgow to Strathblane, go up the hills, go along the Campsies, come down the Tatmadoon Road at Tweka, and then walk into Glasgow. One day.
Yeah.
One day.
Yeah.
You know? And I suppose if you had one day off, you know, out of 7 days, if you're working in the shipyards or something, that's what you had to do.
Yeah. Well, guys like Tom Weir and Jock Nimlin, they used to go travel up by car or bus up to Balmaha, and they would row all night. They would row up to the head of the loch to do the cobbler, and sometimes further on up into Glencoe to do these climbs, and then back to work on the Monday. Yeah. I mean, they were tough, tough guys.
Just extraordinary.
Among the people that I did meet on the West Island Way the first time I ever did it, that stretch between Rowardennan and Inversnaid along the loch side, mm-hmm, it was very difficult to negotiate that. You know, there was no striding out. It was all scrambling and climbing and stumbling about over roots and boulders. And I met two wee men. They were about maybe 5'2". And about 8.5 stone soaking wet, wee wiry guys. One of them was 82 and the other one was 83, carrying their bikes. They were cyclists and were carrying their bikes from Inversnaid to Rowardennan to pick up the road back into Glasgow, wherever they lived, you know. And I thought, these are tough, tough guys, you know. But that was a generational thing as well. They were like that, you know. Yeah. And there was the story about the old, the Kregalian fire. And you would walk past Kregalian when you did it. And the story then was that the Kregalian fire was lit by the old outdoor guys who wrapped themselves in newspaper at night to sleep, like the old tramps used to do. And the story was that Kregalian fire was never allowed to go out. Now, I would love to believe that, you know. Yeah. But certainly it was kept going by the old outdoor fellas, you know. But you did it. You must have enjoyed it, surely.
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. You know, but you know what saved me? You were talking about the Kregalian fire. Because I set off and I was in work mode. I'm not here to enjoy myself. I'm here to do a job.
Oh, I quite, yeah.
You know, because I was just by myself and I was recording by myself. And I was kind of marching out and I was thinking about time and distance. And and I met a guy called Neil in the woods just at Carbeth. I heard somebody breaking sticks and I smelt smoke.
Oh,
and I went in, there's a guy sitting there beside a fire. And I said, hello, how are you doing? And he went, oh, I'm fine, fine, fine. And I says, I like a fire. He says, oh, come sit down. And I got chatting to him, and it just hit me. His partner has got a hut up in Carbeth, but it just slowed me right down.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the speed I should be doing this at. I don't care if anybody's streaming past me.
Yeah.
And just about everybody did. But it just allowed me to take my time and enjoy it more.
Well, I didn't have any time limit set on me walking it either, you know. And I admired the guys. I mean, I met some people later on when I was doing the television one, a couple of years later, guys from the police or the army, and they were treating it as an exercise, you know. And we had a wee guy, at the time I was doing McGregor's Gathering, there was a wee Irish fella who was a painter in the BBC. I mean, he was like the fourth prince. He just kept painting it all the time and starting again. And he was a wee man, maybe about 5'3" or 5'4". And 60 years old, and he had run it in something like 26 hours or something like that. And he said, I know I can do it quicker than that, you know. I thought, what's the point? But, I mean, he just saw it as a physical challenge. My attitude was entirely different. My attitude when I'm walking, even here in Kilbachan, is still different. I'm very, very happy to stop and stare at a beetle crawling up a rock or a plant that I haven't seen before. Stop and look, you know. What was his name again? There's a Adam Watson,
yes,
of the Institute of Terrestrial Ecology.
Yeah.
I did a walk with him in the Cairngorms and it was fantastic. I mean, I used to fancy myself that I knew quite a lot about the countryside and wildlife now. To have a walk with this man, 300 yards was an education because everything you passed, he could tell you. We turned up a tree with had been upturned in the roots, and he spent about 20 minutes explaining how this upturned roots had created a wee microclimate underneath the roots and all the different things, different plants and wee creepy crawlies that were existing in there because of this microclimate. And I thought, people like that are worth their weight in gold, like Attenborough is, you know. Yeah.
I greatly admire anybody that, you know, you kind of get in the loan of their eyes. You see the world in a completely
phrase,
different way.
That's a good phrase. Yeah, well, I did, when I was doing McGregor's Gang, I was asked to do quite a lot with kids, you know, schools. And it was kind of horrifying that you could take them on a walk and they heard nothing, saw nothing, felt nothing, and you had to keep pointing out that was a goldfinch. Did you hear that? What, you know, to tongue hanging out, and you're trying to educate them to listen and look when they're outside and just find out what the world's all about. And thank God for people. I mean, we keep talking about Attenborough. He's not the only one, but he's been magical in how he's opened people's consciousness to the wonders that are around them. I'm very grateful for the fact that I've always been conscious of the world around me and having this sort of natural empathy with the natural world, because there's so much pleasure from it over the years, and still do. I think I wrote somewhere about I still I mean, I'm 90 years old now, and I still get the same thrill out of finding something like a thrush's nest with those fantastic blue speckled eggs and the kind of papier-mâché lining that they create inside it. It just, I still get quite turned on by it. Things like that.
Looking back on all the stuff you've done in a very full, very productive, very inspiring 90 years, what are you proudest of?
Surviving to 90.
Against all predictions.
I don't think I'm particularly proud of anything, because I do think of my whole life as being kind of self-indulgence, doing things that I love, and if there's a spin-off of benefit to other folk, that's wonderful. And if I've opened people's eyes and ears to the countryside, that's, I suppose I could be a wee bit proud of that. I've helped, at least in that way. But I don't have any great pretensions about myself at all, really.